Yesterday we were discussing Solomon, and today I have a couple of more things that I want to mention about Solomon, except from a different perspective, which is going to head us in a direction that we want to go today. So then, as grand as the reign of Solomon was, with all his riches and his gold and his wealth and his respect and all these things, it was evident that Yahweh was not real pleased with what was happening with Solomon. Moses had warned the people in Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, that when a king was set up over Israel, that there were certain things that he should and should not do. So let's go over to the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy. Anyway, the first slide there, we're going to take a quantum leap today. We're going to try to cover some areas between about 930 B.C., which would have been around the end of Solomon, and we're going to make our way to 1945. Okay, Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, and we want to begin reading at verse 14. Deuteronomy 17, beginning at verse 14. Says, when thou art come into the land, which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and thou shalt say, I will set a king over me, like as the nations that are about me. Thou shalt in any wise set him king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among thy brethren shalt thou set over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother. Then verses 16 and 17. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to that end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, ye shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall ye multiply wives unto yourself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. So then the wording of these four verses here in the book of Deuteronomy that Moses is speaking, it almost speaks, in fact it does speak directly to Solomon himself. Because part of the glory of Solomon was his 4,000 horses and his stables, his silver and his gold, his 300 wives and his 700 concubines. So these were the things that brought Solomon glory. These were the things that brought Solomon pleasure. And that was in a direct disregard to what Moses said in Deuteronomy, the 17th chapter, that this king that you set up over you, or that I will set up over you, shall not multiply horses, shall not multiply wives, shall not multiply gold and silver. So God was not pleased with what was going on with Solomon. And so what happened to Solomon was that which had been forewarned by Yahweh. That is, Solomon allowed himself to be led away by human desires and the idols of his wives. And in 1 Kings, the 11th chapter, we see the net result of these things. 1 Kings 11 and verse 9. Turn over there to that, please. First Kings 11, and we begin reading in verse 9. And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord commanded. Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, forasmuch as this is done of thee, thou shalt not keep and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and will give it to thy servant. Notwithstanding in thy days, I will not do it for David thy servant's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Of course, it was Rehoboam. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdoms, but will give one tribe to thy son for David my servant's sake, for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. So then Solomon, of course, was the wisest man on earth, yet he was still a human being, just as you and I are. And Christ, the one who was greater than Solomon, said in Matthew, the 6th chapter in verse 12, that where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And that was especially true of Solomon. And it's true with us as well. So then for us, that treasure can assume any manifestation. Whatever detracts us from the word and the service of Yahweh, that's where our heart is going to be. So our responsibility then is priority, dedication, and focus. Priority, dedication, and focus. And these are the things that we should concentrate on. Okay, moving along with Israel of the past, what we have here is a chronology of the tribes of Judah and the tribes of Israel. And during the time from the beginning of Rehoboam's reign, from about 931 B.C. to the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., which was around 345 years, the tribe of Benjamin and Judah had 6 good kings out of 20. Actually, 6 good kings out of 19 and 1 queen, Athaliah. And then during a similar period of the 10 tribes of Israel, beginning with Jeroboam, also about 931 B.C., and ending with Hosea, which was actually around 722 B.C. And that was a period of something that less than 210 years. And Israel had, of course, 19 kings, and they were all what? They were all bad kings, every one of them. And it was around this date of 722 B.C. that the northern kingdom of Israel was taken captive, and they were scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire and further yet. The history of Judah, however, is kept before us in the scripture, even to the present day, because Judah is to form the nucleus of God's purpose. And from that nucleus, a regathered nation of Israel will come together, just as Ezekiel 37 predicts. And we'll get into Ezekiel 37 a little more later. In 586 B.C., Jerusalem and Solomon's temple came crumbling down at the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. So whatever splendor there had remained of the era of Solomon, it was completely wasted now. Judah's kingdom was taken away captive, and the remnant became subservient to whatever power was in control of the Middle East, namely Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, or whoever was in control of the Middle East. Now, concerning this Grecian power that we just mentioned, we know that after the death of Alexander the Great, the kingdom was divided among 4 of his leading commanders. They are Seleucus, Ptolemy, Lysimachus, and Cassander, and those are the areas into which they were divided. Seleucus, Ptolemy, Lysimachus, and Cassander. And during the latter end of the era of this fourfold division, which was about 168 B.C., there came a glimmer of hope for the nation of Israel, or for Judah, and a vision of former things at the end of the reign of a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, which is pictured there on the left. And just for your information, and this is going to play into something we're going to talk about tomorrow, but anyway, that's a bust of Antiochus Epiphanes. Take a good look at that man. We'll recognize him some more tomorrow. But anyway, the name Antiochus appended the name Epiphanes to himself because Epiphanes means God manifests, and he looked at himself as though he were a god. But most of his contemporaries looked at him, and they named him Epimenes, which means madman. So keep that in mind, because that's going to play big tomorrow. The madman, Antiochus Epiphanes, no doubt he was a madman. Okay, Antiochus Epiphanes reigned as king over the Seleucid Empire, which included Syria from 175 to 164 BC. And at that time, that section of the old empire occupied the area of the king of the north. The Seleucid Empire occupied the territory that was known as the king of the north. Antiochus made two major military expeditions to Egypt, and on his second campaign to the south in 168 BC, he went to make war with the Ptolemies, whose division of the Grecian Empire at that time became known as the King of the South. And just before Antiochus arrived at Egypt, he was intercepted by a single Roman official who informed him that if he didn't give up his plan to invade Egypt, he could consider himself in a state of war with the Roman Republic. And I was talking to Al yesterday, and there's a little story that goes along with that. So we got the whole army of Antiochus headed south and almost in Egypt when there appears one Roman soldier. He was an official of the Roman Republic. And he stepped out and he told him, you know, if you come down here into Egypt and try to make war, you can consider yourself in a state of war with the entire Roman Republic. Needless to say, that was that incensed Antiochus. So Antiochus is, according to the story or the account, Antiochus's reply to that was, well, I need to think about this a while. So when Antiochus said that, the Roman soldier pulled out his sword. He drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus and said, before you leave that circle, I'll have my answer. So needless to say, that really upset Antiochus. So what did he do then? This ultimatum made him so mad that he headed back north and east to Jerusalem to put down a minor rebellion and vent his anger on the Jews. Okay, now we're working on a type here, so keep in mind, we've got Antiochus, the king of the north. He went south to make war with Egypt. And then he went back north and east to Jerusalem. Antiochus hated the Jews, and he was glad to wreak bloody havoc on the 40,000 men, women, and children. And many of those that he didn't kill, he sold into slavery. The rest he Hellenized and forced them to commit sacrilege by offering swine's flesh upon the altar of the temple. And he forced them to eat unclean foods. He installed a statue of a Greek god Jupiter in the temple. And those who refused to worship the false god were killed. Now, a few months later, in a small town named Modiene, and you can see it. Now, let's see. Modiene is about 15 to 17 miles, right there. It's about 15 to 17 miles northwest of Jerusalem. And in that town, there lived an old priest by the name of Mattathias, surnamed Maccabeus. And the name Mattathias means gift of Yahweh, and the surname Maccabeus means hammer. And as it turned out, Mattathias was indeed a gift of Yahweh because of his zeal for the truth. And that zeal for the truth turned him into the hammer of Yahweh. Antiochus, being too busy with other affairs after the initial destruction of Jerusalem and the killing of the Jews, Antiochus was a little bit too busy with other affairs, so he dispatched an officer to go back to Israel and to make sure that the Jews were being converted to Hellenism as planned. So when the officer came to see Mattathias in Modiene, his intent was to enlist his help in the conversion of the Jews. And this is taken from the first book of Maccabees, chapter 2, and this is what Mattathias' response was to this officer that came to enlist his help. Then Mattathias answered and spake with a loud voice, though all nations that are under the king's dominion obey him and fall away every one from the religion of their fathers, and give consent to his commandments, yet will I and my sons and my brethren walk in the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law and the ordinances. We will not hearken to the king's words to go from our religion, either on the right hand or on the left. Now when he had left off speaking these words, there came one of the Jews in the sight of all to sacrifice on the altar, which was at Modin, according to the king's commandment. Which thing, when Mattathias saw, he was inflamed with zeal, his reins trembled, neither could he forbear to show his anger, according to judgment. Wherefore he ran, and he slew him upon the altar. Also the king's commissioner, who compelled men to sacrifice, he killed at that time. And the altar he pulled down, thus dealt he zealously for the law of God, like as Phinehas did unto Zimri, the son of Salam. And Mattathias cried throughout the city with a loud voice, saying, Whosoever is zealous for the law, or of the law, and maintaineth the covenant, let him follow me. And that's a picture of Mattathias on the top there, and it's his son, one of his sons, Judas, on the bottom. And so, with this, the Maccabean revolt began, but Mattathias only lived for about a year after this, but his third son, Judas Maccabeus, which means praise, also surnamed Hammer, took control of the Jewish rebels and succeeded in driving the forces of Antiochus out of Israel. The battles that Judas and his forces were engaged in with the Seleucids were something miraculous. Judas had 3,000 men, and with those 3,000 men, he defeated the army of Lysias, who had 47,000 men in one battle. And again, with an Assyrian officer named Timotheus, he defeated him, who had 20,000 men. And with that same 3,000 men, he also defeated in a battle a second time with Lysias. And this time they defeated 65,000 men. So look at the miraculousness of what's going on here. The Maccabees were outnumbered 15-1 on a number of occasions, but the Jews continued to defeat the enemy with victory after victory. So then, with peace now in Jerusalem, defeating their enemy, work then began on the temple. It was cleansed of all that had defiled it, and worship was restored. There was a rededication of the temple that had happened on the 25th of Kislev, which is roughly our late November and early December, in 164 B.C. The celebration lasted 8 days, and today that celebration is known as the Festival of Lights, or Hanukkah. So when you think Israel is celebrating Christmas, they're celebrating Hanukkah. They're celebrating the liberation of Jerusalem. Now, to summarize these events, we see the king of the north, that is the Seleucids, driving south to Egypt to make war with the then king of the south, that is the Ptolemies. There then entered the mind of the king of the north to go back to Jerusalem to capture and destroy the city and the temple, which in fact he did. Then out of nowhere, and this is the most amazing thing about this, when Antiochus was doing this, just out of nowhere the Maccabees appear. Where do they come from? Who are they? The scripture doesn't mention them except in one place, so we're going to look at that in a minute. But in the narration of the history, the Maccabees aren't there. But just bingo, out of nowhere appears, and that plays into the type as well, out of nowhere appears the Maccabees. Although no names are mentioned, these events were prophesied in the 11th chapter of Daniel in verses 32 to 34. And I've supplied some names here, and I'll get to why I did that here in just a minute. But in Daniel, the 11th chapter, verses 32 through 34, we read this, "And such as do wickedly against the covenant, that is Antiochus, shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they, that is Mattathias and his five sons, that understand among the people, shall instruct many. Yet they shall fall by the sword, and by flame, and by captivity, and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be hoping of a little help, but many shall cleave to them, that is, the Maccabees, by flatteries." And the word flatteries here is from the root, which means to take away a portion or to separate, and which is exactly what Antiochus did. He separated many of the Jews, converted them to Hellenism with the promise of wealth and power under his reign. And if you want the full account of this, you can go to Elpis Israel on page 414 and 415 of the Logos edition. And Brother Thomas will there paraphrase Daniel 11 for you and add all the names that you need to know, the historical characters that are being spoken of there in Daniel 11. So as Daniel 11:34 says, "They shall be hoping of a little help." This help came from the Maccabees, but it was short-lived. As the little horn of the goat, that is Rome, the abomination that would make desolate, would now occupy Israel. Okay, and from this point, we're going to quickly highlight a few things that happened over the next couple of millennia. So again, we move forward about 235 years to a time just prior to the conclusion of the prophecy of the 70 weeks, a time just prior to the prophecy of the 70 weeks, where in Matthew, the 24th chapter, verses 1 through 3, Jesus had this to say. "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and the end of the world? And of course, the answer that the apostles received was much more than they would understand at that time. They asked Jesus about the establishment of the promised kingdom, but he spoke to them of a prophecy that would have its fulfillment in about 40 years from the time he spoke. The destruction of Jerusalem came in AD 70, and that would eclipse anything that had previously befallen the city or its inhabitants. Josephus records that the loss of life exceeded 1.1 million. And Emperor Titus was hailed as the great conqueror and the great king, and in his honor, a great arch was erected in Rome to commemorate this wonderful achievement that he had made. And this arch was built in 81 AD, 11 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. And on the inside of that arch shows the Romans taking off the plunder of the temple at that time. And of course, that is not what they carried off was not the original lampstand. That had been gone for some time. That was a recreation of it, but nonetheless, it was still gold. Okay, and then because of the third Jewish revolt, which began under Simon Bar Kokhba in 132 and continuing to 136 A.D., the Roman Emperor Hadrian became determined to erase Judaism from the entire province. Hadrian quelled the revolt. He then leveled what remained of Jerusalem. He banished the Jews and forbade them from entering the city upon the pain of death. The death toll during this five-year period was more than 580,000 Jews. A new Roman-style city was built where Jerusalem once stood. The new city was named Aulia Capitolina, And the whole Judean province was renamed Syria, Palestinia, and the name remained so for about the next 500 years. And that coin that you're looking at there, I know it's kind of hard to see. It's a picture of, or an engraving of Emperor Hadrian. And then on the right side, it's Emperor Hadrian, plowing with an ox. And he's plowing up Jerusalem in preparation for the new city of Aelia Capitolina. Now it's said that this all was the most ruthless and comprehensive attempt to eradicate Judaism from the face of the earth, and from the Roman perspective, the Eastern Jewish problem was now solved. As far as Hadrian was concerned, he had done exactly what he intended to do, and he wiped out the Jews. No doubt the time of the Gentiles were fully manifest, and for the following 2,000 years, that hatred of the Jewish people has continued. And it was all done under the accusation that the Jews were Christ killers. The 42nd generation of the Jews were, in fact, responsible for the murder of their Messiah. But to blame succeeding generations of Jews of that crime is the same as blaming the Gentiles of today for carrying out the execution of Christ, which nobody, of course, is prepared to do. Throughout history, many nations have tried to do the same as the Romans, but as the Romans, they failed to complete the murderous execution of a complete nation. And the reason why is clear only to a few, because the eradication of God's people is not in God's plan. He intended for Israel to survive, and survive they have. In Deuteronomy, the 4th chapter, beginning in verse 26, we read this. I call to heaven and earth to witness against you this day that ye shall soon utterly perish from off the land. They shall perish from off the land. They shall not perish themselves, but they would perish from the land of promise. They would be driven elsewhere. That ye shall soon utterly perish from the land whereinto ye go over Jordan to possess it. Ye shall not prolong your days upon it, but ye shall be utterly destroyed off of the land. And the Lord shall scatter you among the nations, and ye shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. And then in verse 31, it says, For the Lord thy God is a merciful God. He will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee, nor forget the covenant of thy fathers, which he sware unto them. Then in Jeremiah, the 30th chapter, in verse 11, the prophet declares, For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations, whether I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. So, when I read about that, the first thing that pops into my mind is an old saying that I have been unable to find the author of. And if anybody else has ever heard of this or something similar to it, I would appreciate you telling me who wrote it. But the author is, the quote is, The reviled and persecuted Jews have stood at the graveside of every ancient persecutor. I thought that would be easy to find, but it wasn't. I found it quoted someplace, but they didn't quote where they got it. So, but anyway, that in fact could not be more true. And then, in a similar thought, this is what Samuel Clemens had to say about the Jews. He wrote in 1897, If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 0.25% of the human race. It suggests a nebulous puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of. But he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, abstruse learning are also out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous fight in this world in all ages and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Persians rose. They filled the planet with sound and splendor. Then they faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greeks and the Romans followed and made a vast noise, and they were gone. Other people have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now and have vanished. The Jews saw them, survived them all, and is now what he has always been, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert but aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jews. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Of course, we all understand the answer to that question, but most people don't speak quite as kindly of the Jews as did Mark Twain. This is a list of just a few people who have also had things to say about the Jews, and they've all had something bad, very bad, to say about the Jews. And that list is probably three times that long, and the article from which this was taken was a paper entitled What Famous Men Have Said About the Jews. And the whole thing would take hours to read because there are quotations from each of these people. So I just listed a few of the more prominent names of people who have had some very bad things to say about the Jews. Their sentiments, I think, are representative of the clear majority of the population, both during their times and now. So anti-Semitism is nothing new, and Martin Luther was probably the worst one of them. The Jews have suffered persecution from every country where they've been scattered. During the years from 1348 to 1350, the Black Plague gripped Europe, and about 20 to 25 million Europeans died, and the whole thing was blamed on the Jews. They were accused of poisoning the water wells, and as a result, the Christian survivors set out to kill the Jews, and there's no accurate numbers that I can find that remain, but estimates of Jewish deaths range upwards to 100,000. The fact is that the Jews had nothing to do with it, but the Christians were looking for a scapegoat for other reasons, and I read this little tidbit of information in about three different historical accounts. The Christians were looking for a scapegoat for other reasons, including the fact that the Jews of the day were financiers of Christian businesses, so killing the Jews was a convenient way to get out of debt. So they were pleased to kill the Jews just to escape the debt. Of course, it was finally determined that rats infested with fleas were inadvertently brought to Genoese, Italy on cargo ships, and this began the period of the Black Death. Now, about 590 years later, the Holocaust of World War II claimed another 6 million Jewish lives. And the Allied forces here were seen as the saviors of the Jew at the end of the war in May of 1945. Keep that in mind. The Allied forces, that is Britain, the United States, Australia, and Canada, and several others, they were seen as, and I didn't name Russia in there, but they were part of the Allied forces, but not really. They were seen as the saviors of the Jews, which in fact they were. They did liberate the concentration camps, but there were a lot of other things that were going on behind the scenes that proved that anti-Semitism in those days was running rampant. Once they liberated them, they didn't know what to do with them. They didn't want them. No country wanted them. And we'll have some more to say about that just here in Jiffy. Okay, so however, anti-Semitism was just as strong in Britain as it was in the United States, as it was in Europe. The pleas from American Jews to Roosevelt to aid in the rescue efforts of the European Jews were met with bureaucratic log jams. And this picture in the upper right-hand corner shows General Patton, General Bradley, and General Eisenhower at the Buchenwald concentration camp, and these are some of the things that they saw there. In 1943, Secretary of State Breckinridge Long, in charge of the Immigration Department, claimed that the U.S. had admitted over 500,000 Jewish refugees since 1933, but this was proven to be a lie. And this is a quotation from, this is on the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. It's a plaque that's there, and this is a quotation from General Dwight D. Eisenhower concerning the Buchenwald concentration camp. He says, "The things that I saw beggar description. The visual evidence and the verbal testimony of starvation, cruelty, bestiality were overpowering. I made the visit deliberately in order to be in a position to give firsthand evidence of these things if ever in the future there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda." And he wrote that letter April 15th, 2 days after he visited Buchenwald. Does it not seem as Dwight Eisenhower was a prophet there? He wanted to go on record as saying, "I personally saw these things because there might be a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda." And that's exactly what happened. How many people today deny the Holocaust? Okay, in 1943, Secretary of State Breckinridge Long, in charge of the Immigration Department, claimed that the U.S. had admitted over 500,000 Jewish refugees since 1933, but all that was proven to be a lie. Okay, in fact, when Mr. Long was ambassador to Italy before he became secretary, he was impressed with Mussolini and Hitler. He was considered pro-fascist, anti-Semitic by some, and he was considered as an American Eichmann by others. And what you're looking at there on the bottom right is the cover of a book. And the title of the book is Breckinridge Long, American Eichmann, ? After that. Breckinridge Long, an American Eichmann. And Breckinridge Long excused himself by saying that he believed that many of these Jewish refugees were actually German agents and sympathizers, and he denied visas to the Jews. Finally, at the insistence of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, 5,000 Jewish children were allowed to come to the United States. Long was dismissed in 1944, but things didn't improve much. And this is a State Department memo that Breckinridge Long wrote to all State Department officials. And he says, "We can delay effectively, stop for a temporary period of indefinite length, the number of immigrants to the United States. We could do this by simply advising our consuls to put every obstacle in the way and to require additional evidence and to resort to various administrative devices which would postpone and postpone and postpone the granting of visas. However, this could only be temporary in order to make it more definite. It would have to be done by suspension of the rules under the law of the issuance of the proclamation of emergency, which I take it we are not yet ready to proclaim." So Breckinridge Long was prepared to do anything that he could to stop the migration of Jews to the United States. The point is that the United States could have saved millions of Jews had they allowed visas. They could have issued millions of visas to allow the Jews to escape Europe, but they didn't. They kept them over there because they didn't want them. The British didn't want them. Australians didn't want them. Nobody wanted the Jews. Only Poland, after the war, would allow some of the Jews to come back. Okay, this is for my general information, but what I want to know, and I'd like to see a show of hands, please, is there anybody here who does not know or who has never heard of Eichmann? If you've never heard of Eichmann, raise your hand. If you've never heard of Eichmann, raise your hand. Okay. That's Adolf Eichmann. Adolf Eichmann was the Holocaust He was the architect of the Holocaust, and he is solely responsible for the death of 5 million Jews. Take a really good look at this guy. Don't forget him. I could put up a whole bunch of pictures of German SS officers who are also guilty, but this man is the most guilty. And I'll go ahead and tell you a little story about Adolf Eichmann. They actually captured Adolf Eichmann in 1945 at the end of the war, but he was not wearing a uniform. The people that captured him really didn't know who he was. So as a result of that, he escaped. And for the next 4 to 5 years, he wandered around in Germany and in Austria. And finally, he managed to make his way down to Italy, and he was home free when he got to Italy because of something called the Odessa Program. Anybody familiar with the Odessa Program? Odessa was an organization of SS Nazi officials, and they would prepare the way for some of these Nazi officers to escape after the war. And they would lead them into Italy to the Roman Catholic Church. And when they were in the Catholic Church prepared visas for them. They prepared all sorts of paperwork for them. They changed their names and saw to them that they were able to get out of the country. Catholic Church was doing that. Okay. Adolf Eichmann did in fact manage to escape. He made it all the way to Argentina. And he stayed down there about 10 years. And there was a man named Simon Wiesenthal who was a Nazi hunter. And Simon Wiesenthal tipped off the Mossad, which is the Israeli intelligence service, probably the best in the world. And they sent a team of Mossad agents to Argentina in 1960. They captured him and they brought him back to Israel to stand trial. And for 2 years, he stood trial. And they found him guilty. They hanged him. They cremated him. They took his ashes out beyond their own territorial waters into the Mediterranean Ocean, and they dumped his ashes in the Mediterranean Sea because they didn't want any remains of him to be in Israel that someone could bring and put up a shrine, as this man might have been a martyr to some sympathizers. Okay, he changed his name to Ricardo Clement. They caught him. They brought him back to Israel. And this is in his testimony while he was being tried. This is some of the things that Adolf Eichmann said. He says, "I do not take on the job as a senseless exercise. It gave me uncommon joy. I found it fascinating to have to deal with these matters." And then he says, "To be frank with you, if we had killed all of them, all 10.3 million, I would be happy to say, all right, we managed to kill and destroy the enemy, that is, the Jews." And one more, he said, "I would leap laughing into the grave because the feeling that I had 5 million people on my conscience would be for me a source of extraordinary satisfaction." So you younger folks who never heard of Adolf Eichmann, take a good look at that man. Don't forget who he is because he's going to be important. He was important as far as the Jews were concerned. Okay, after the liberation of the concentration camps in 1945, the Allies set up DP camps. DP camps were displaced persons camps. And they did that to house the former POWs. Sometimes the concentration camps themselves were used for this project. The idea being that the camps would be staging areas to return the refugees to their former homes or relocate them. But the result was that hardly any country wanted them. Only Poland opened the doors to the Jews. This was after the war. Concerning the DP camps, there were about 2 million displaced persons, and among them were about 250,000 Jews. In the summer of 1945, Harry Truman asked former U.S. Immigration Commissioner Earl Harriman to tour the DP camps, and Harrison was shocked by what he found, and he informed Truman and said, "We appear to be treating the Jews as the Nazis treated them, except that we don't exterminate them." And based on Harrison's report, the United States established separate camps for the Jewish DPs. For the most part then, the Jews were on their own to reorganize their lives, which in fact they did, as they had always done, and within 3 years of World War II, life would change dramatically for the Jew, and we'll take up there tomorrow.